Right. Are we there? Should we start talking?
Yeah, I'm
Perfect.
here. Yeah.
Well, I was going to title this Modern Communications, this particular podcast, but that might be wrong given we've spent half an hour trying to hook each other up.
Actually, I timed it. It was 47 minutes.
47 minutes? Okay, so I definitely won't call it that.
How many creative people does it take to make a phone call?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the answer is way too many.
So, thanks for making time to have a chat, Bob. Really appreciate it.
My great pleasure, yes.
So, I think at the moment we're in a sort of funny stage, I think, in advertising or whatever it's called today. And I think you seem to be one of the few people who's sort of in the fog, has a torch, or, you know, most people can't see the wood for the trees. So we're going to get to that a little bit later. Yeah. But first, I thought we'd talk a bit about where you started and how you kind of grew up. So I was just going to ask where you were born.
Okay. I was born in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
And I spent my first 10 years in Brooklyn, and then my family moved to another part of New York City called Far Rockaway, which is a beach town as far away from the center of New York City as you can get. Actually, the next town over, you're not in New York City anymore.
Isn't that where Woody Allen grew up?
No, he didn't. He grew up in Brooklyn. He made a movie about Rockaway.
Okay.
Called Radio Days.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm thinking.
In which he purported to grow up in Rockaway, but he actually didn't.
Okay. And as a child in Rockaway, what was the first ad you can remember ever seeing?
Oh, boy.
Did any ever make an impression?
I can remember an ad for something called Ipana toothpaste.
Right.
And it was a cartoon with a character called Bucky Beaver.
Bucky Beaver. Wow.
Bucky Beaver. And Bucky Beaver had like these two big front teeth, and he would sing a song about Ipana toothpaste.
God.
I'd love to see that spot now. I'm sure it's hilarious.
I can think of about seven reasons why that wouldn't run today with just the minimal information you've given me. But
right.
So, growing up, was there any of... Did you take much notice of advertising? Did you think that seems cool, or was it just wallpaper in the background that occasionally would get through?
Yeah, I didn't really think... I didn't pay much attention to advertising, although I did watch a fair amount of television. I listened to radio an awful lot. I was a big rock and roll fan. And so I got my fill of advertising. It's not like I wasn't... It wasn't like I was sheltered from it, but I didn't really pay too much attention to it. And I really had, growing up, I had no idea that advertising was even a profession or that I would want to be in it. So I came to advertising reasonably late,
right?
Not having had any kind of ambition to be in the advertising business.
Okay. Did you go to the Pratt Institute? Is that right?
No.
No.
I didn't study advertising or I've never taken an advertising or marketing course in my life. I've only read one or two books.
Right.
So I'm far from a scholar on advertising, but somehow I wound up being in the agency business for over 40 years. So I kind of stumbled my way into advertising, I guess.
So you used to be a science teacher, is that right?
I was a teacher, yeah. I taught for a few years in New York City, and I was a terrible teacher. I was the world's worst teacher. I have no patience, and
right.
I'm not nurturing, you know.
Yep. That comes through on your blog.
teachers are wonderful people, and I'm not a wonderful person. So it didn't really, it wasn't really for me. I did it for a few years, but I really was not very good at it.
So how did you switch from teaching to advertising?
It was about 3 or 4 years after I had left college and I had been teaching, and I had quit teaching, and I was kind of a bum. And I ran into a friend of mine from college who I hadn't seen in a few years, and I asked him what he's doing. And he said, "I'm working in advertising." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" He says, "Well, you know the commercials on TV?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, I write those." And honestly, it had never occurred to me that there were civilized people who actually sat down and wrote those things. I just thought somehow they appeared on television. I never really connected that someone had to do that. So, and he said to me, we had written some stuff together in college. He said to me, "You know what? You would be really good at this." So I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." So I said, "Okay, well, that sounds interesting. What do I do?" So he told me to how to make up a sample portfolio of ads, which I did. What I did was I just ripped out some magazine ads that I thought were lousy and rewrote them. I didn't have an art director or design person to work with, so I just did my own stupid paste-ups.
Okay.
And he hooked me up with a lady called Judy Wald in New York City. Judy Wald was like the goddess.
Okay.
Of advertising placements in New York City, and she placed everyone everywhere, and I went to see her, and she hated my portfolio, told me I'd never get a job in advertising, but by then I was already kind of committed to it, so I kept looking, and I found a job. There was a newspaper that's still there in New York called The Village Voice, and it was published out of Greenwich Village, and they had kind of like, in addition to regulation jobs, they had kind of oddball jobs in there also, and I used to check the classified there, and I came upon an ad for Panasonic, the electronics company, was looking for a copywriter for their in-house agency. And I applied, and I got lucky, and I got the job. And that's where I started my, writing in the advertising department.
So what, Bob, what attributes do you think your friend recognized that he thought would make you suitable for advertising? Or did he just think, that's not hard, you could probably do it?
I think... he thought I was clever.
Okay.
I think that's what he saw, and I had a fairly good sense of humor, and it was the time in advertising when creativity was to some degree defined by cleverness and humor.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think he thought I would be good at it.
So you get into the Panasonic department writing ads.
Yeah.
Presumably there's not much outlet for creativity and humor at that point, or is there?
No, there is. Actually, I was very lucky because, so it was a pretty big department. We had about 40 people in the advertising department there. And we had two agencies working for us. We had Ted Bates, which was a big agency in those days, doing our consumer-facing advertising. And then because Panasonic is a Japanese company and you're kind of like required by law to have Dentsu as one of your agencies in those days, Dentsu was our agency for B2B stuff. And, they were just plain flat out terrible. And so we had to do most of the B2B advertising in the advertising department. And we were very lucky in that the guy who managed the advertising department had a very specific point of view about B2B advertising. And his point of view, and it was very enlightened, I thought. His point of view was that the person who's reading our trade ads during the day at his desk is the same person who's reading our consumer ads in Time magazine in the evening. It's just he's wearing a different hat.
And he
insisted that the trade advertising look and feel and smell and be as good as the consumer advertising.
Yeah.
And so we were doing trade ads that were good, not just, you know, girls standing by, you know, girls in bikinis standing by copy machines.
Yeah.
These were pretty good high quality ads. And so I was lucky in that respect. Now, there was also plenty of crappy stuff to do in the ad department. We had to write brochures and catalogs and, you know, spec sheets and stuff like that. But we did get to do high-quality print ads, and we also got to do some TV spots, which were done for the trade. So we would create a spot, and then we'd give it to one of our one of the companies who distributed Panasonic products. They tag their logo at the end of it, but we got to produce the spots. So it was a pretty good training ground for me. I enjoyed it a lot.
So that's a bit of luck then, working with someone who had that insight, because there's still a lot of marketing directors who still don't know that that's the case, that the people looking at their trade ads also look at TV and other things at the night.
That's right.
So at what point did you find out about the creative revolution and the whole different way of doing things in New York, particularly PKL and DDB and those guys?
Yeah, I was about, I don't know, 5 to 10 years behind that. So I came into the agency business when those people had already revolutionized advertising to some degree. And it was, in my mind, there was the old staid kind of old-fashioned university boy kind of advertising guys who were, you know, pre-Mad Men era. And then in New York, it became a little more ethnic. You had a lot of Italian art directors, really good Italians coming in doing nice art directing, and Jewish guys doing writing. And that had already happened by the time I got into the advertising business in New York. So I didn't really straddle those two eras. I came in when the creative revolution was already in full swing. And frankly, I only spent 2 years in New York working in the advertising business, and I wasn't in an agency. I was in a so I was kind of well out of the mainstream of the agency world in New York. But then I went to San Francisco, and I got a job in an agency.
And was that a life change, or was that just a better job?
That was a life change. That was my wife nagging me for 2 years, saying, I want to go to San Francisco. So after a while, you give up and you say, okay, let's go.
Yeah.
So we went there, and I knew nothing about San Francisco. I knew nothing about the agency business even, and I certainly knew nothing about the agency business in San Francisco. So what I did was I went to the Yellow Pages, and I went through the Yellow Pages, and the first agency I found started with an A. It was called Allen and Dorwood, and I went there, and I showed them my book, and they hired me. So that was good. And it was a small agency, and it wasn't terribly good. It was mainly B2B and industrial kind of stuff, but I didn't know, and I just started there, and And we grew the agency. The agency grew very nicely, and we started to get some consumer-facing accounts. And I did very well there, and the agency did well. As a matter of fact, for a while there, we became the largest independent agency in San Francisco.
Right.
And that didn't last very long because Hal Reiney opened his agency, and
yep.
he blew us away pretty quick. He was amazing. He was a genius.
So I've got a question. I'm going to cunningly try and link back then to today.
Okay.
So what would your goals have been in trying to create an ad then? In terms of, I guess, you know, when I started, I'd be trying to think, how do I get noticed? How do I do something that people are going to like? You know, what were your sort of parameters when you're sitting down on your own to write an ad then?
My parameters in those days was to do something that pleased me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted the client to like it. But my first order of business was, if I saw this ad, would I like it? If someone else had done it and I looked at it, would I like it?
Yeah.
And that's, in a way, that's a selfish, it's a selfish barometer for how you judge what you're doing. And as I grew in the agency business, I realized that you can't just write ads to please yourself. You also have to write ads that have value as brand builders or as sales builders. But early on, I have to admit, my goals were selfish. I wanted to do ads that I liked.
And what would have made up an ad that you liked? I suppose I'm interested in whether there was a correlation between, Steven Spielberg, when he was asked, I think I saw some documentary over here, and they said, you know, you've got three or four, whatever it was, of the top 10 grossing movies ever. What is it you look for in a script? And he says, I look for something that I would like, that I would watch. He said, I can't guess what other people would like, but if I like it, other people may like it. And I just wonder whether there's a correlation between what you liked and that ad then going on to do well, or whether that was just a slightly, they went two different directions.
Yeah, I don't know. I think having a higher standard than just pleasing the client is very important.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult to please a client usually, you know, and you need to have your own standards of this. Even though I know I could sell this, it's not acceptable to me. I think that's an important value to have. Now, very often, stuff that I thought was good that pleased me turned out to be crap. You can't always trust your own judgment on these kind of things. And I'm sure you've had the same experience. There's stuff in the idea stage that you say to yourself, this is going to be brilliant, this is going to be fabulous.
Yeah.
And then when it's actually produced, it's a piece of crap. And then there's stuff that you say, well, you know what, this isn't, I don't know, I guess it's okay. And then you produce it and it turns out wonderful.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of magic and mystery between the idea stage and the execution stage. Yeah. And you're never really sure about that, but I think you do want to at least have a standard at which you say, you know what, I just... can't do this. This is not good enough, at least for me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was trying to think back when I was sort of starting, and the basic things I would be trying to think that grabbing someone's attention was always a big thing. How do you say something that makes the product or company seem appealing? And then how do you do it in such a simple way that they remember it? It's a very basic thing. And I wonder whether that's changed? Because that would have been...
Yeah, I think it has changed. It's, you know, you can't be inside every agency. You don't know what goes on. All you can see is the results. All you see is what's in front of you. And from what I see, the idea of simplicity has been, I mean, that was one of my core, you know, that was one of the things I think I always tried to do, was to keep simplifying until you get to the heart of something. I don't think that really is a discipline that most agencies practice anymore. I think the time that we used to get when we had a chance to do a new campaign or something helped us not accept the first thing that came along, and it helped us keep thinking and keep digging and keep trying to simplify. I don't think creative people these days have the same luxury of time that we had. It seems like everything is rushed.
Yeah, I guess, but I suppose I wonder why clients come to agencies in the first place, because obviously though people who can deliver those skills are why, that's one of the reasons you go there. So to lose such a core thing of simplification, distilling down, seems like the very essence of what you're trying to do. You're trying to give someone something in a bite-sized form that you can remember. So, and I think you're right that people seem to have discarded distilling as I don't know, because in many ways lots of the things that used to take ages are now very quick. You know, you don't need secretaries to type up scripts and things, you know, your typesetting doesn't come back a day or two later. There's a lot of that part of the process that I guess would build in time for thinking, because there was a certain things you couldn't move, but it's also very quick now to see, to get a sense of a concept. I just wonder why there's not more focus put on simplifying, attention grabbing, some of those things that sound quaintly old fashioned now.
I'm mystified by it also, Dave. I see, to me, the only truly unique value that agencies have for clients is creativity, is imagination. And yet the agency business is very focused these days on other things, on data, on measurement, on things that clients can get better from other suppliers. It's like the agencies are playing the other guy's game.
Absolutely,
and they're losing instead of saying, you know what, we're value to you is in creativity, it's in imagination. That's how we're unique. Not, you know, we have great metric, we have great, everything's focused on data. I think the agency industry doesn't realize that it's committing slow motion suicide by not realizing that the unique value they have to clients is in creativity.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting seeing how that's changed. You know, I remember, where are we now, 2017, perhaps 15 years ago, there'd been a lot of talk about, that's the, you know, we've got an agency in this country and in America called Mother that set up with, at the time, I think 60% of the staff were creative, because that was the way they felt it was going. I foolishly set up an agency where all the partners were the creatives, because I thought, creative resource is the one thing that, you know, now that information is becoming easier to get, the one thing they can't get is imagination and creativity. And that seemed to be the talk at the time of, it's going to be a boom time for creatives. So if you can use your imagination and think differently and use information to create things you can't, to make jumps from the imagination, that's going to become incredibly valuable. And ironically now, It's completely the other way. You know, people talking about big data rather than big ideas. It's just strange how it's panned out, which is not...
if you think about what's happening, if you take a step back and you look at the industry as a whole, the advertising industry used to be an industry of entrepreneurs and craftspeople, right? You'd work at an agency and you wouldn't be happy. You'd be an art director, or you'd be a copywriter, or you'd be a media person. You wouldn't be happy, and you'd start your own agency. Yeah. And then you'd build that, and then there are people who work for you, and they'd be unhappy, and they'd start their own agency. And so you had craftspeople and entrepreneurs building agencies. Now you have the exact opposite. Now you have people who are financiers, who are bankers, who are accountants, buying up all the agencies. They're not craftspeople. They never worked in the agency business per se at a craft. And they are running agencies as if it's a financial institution. They're working on margins and, you know, and all kinds of things that, you know, when you had your agency and I had mine, we didn't really spend, you know, we wanted to make money, but we didn't, that wasn't the focus. The focus was on the work. But now it's different, and I don't know. The structure of the agency business has changed so much. I'm not surprised that the focus has changed.
Do you think it's the phrase I keep hearing about Obamacare? Do you think it's a death spiral where, because less emphasis is focused on the output, it becomes less attractive to people getting into the business? That means there's less energy being put into the work, and it sort of keeps going down.
Is it
rife for a kind of mini revolution where people say, actually, there's another way of doing this? It doesn't all have to be this flat.
Yeah, I am more a pessimist than an optimist. I hope there's a revolution coming. I hope there are still, you know, there are still some wonderful agencies, right? There are still doing great work with, and they have great people. But that's not the bulk of the agency. The bulk of the agency business is not very good. Now, you know, 90% of advertising has always been lousy. Maybe not 90. Let's say 90, just use a number. And we used to have 10% good stuff and 90% mediocre stuff. Well, now we have 93 or 94% mediocre stuff and 6 or 7% good stuff. And that doesn't sound like a big change, but if you think about it, it means there's 30 or 40%. If 10% used to be good, now 60% is good. That means there's 40% less good stuff. And it's noticeable. You feel it. You sense it. It's and the other thing that has, I think, done a terrible disservice to the agency business is the quality of online advertising. So much of it is so terrible, and I don't know why it has to be that way. I don't understand it. I don't understand why it's so terrible.
Well, I had a little while ago, about a year ago, I was overseeing some stuff for a very upmarket hotel chain that the digital department had. And they bought in all these banners and MPUs, and there was things were continually jumping up and down and bouncing around. Yeah. And I said, it seems a bit low rent. Everything's jiggling. I can't follow it. You know, things are sliding in and jumping around. Why have you done it like that? And they went, well, it's digital. That's, you know. I said, I get that. But what's the thinking? Why is there so much movement on every single piece is moving? And they went, well, that's what we do. That's what we normally do. So I said, but is there any reason? And they're all looking blankly. So I said to the planner, can we go and find some research about, you know, things that move against things that don't move? Is this, you know, is the fact that it's all moving and the page is static helping people notice it, or where are we at with it? Because it looks like a mess to me. I can't follow any of it. So the planner went away, and he found out from Google that static banners are 65% more effective than banners that move. And when you get that as a fact, you think, well, that kind of makes sense in a way, because it, you know, the things moving around just become an annoying thing, and you know they're trying to grab your attention, and because they're trying to grab your attention, it's annoying. So I almost, it's like a battle of wills. You think, well, I'm not going to engage with it because it's trying to arrest me. Whether it's if it's calmly and simply trying to grab your attention, I can sort of understand it, but nobody seems to care about, you know. That's what I find with a lot of digital, is it just assumes that there's not a, they're not striving, it's the way certain people do it is replicated over and over, rather than looking for new ways to do it. There doesn't seem as much curiosity in, I mean, it's a huge generalization, obviously, replicating things seems to be very commonplace.
Yeah, to me, the biggest disappointment has been when I was creating advertising, my primary objective, the thing I wanted to do, was to try to build a successful brand. That was to me, that was the highest goal of advertising. If you can build a successful brand, you have done your damn job as an advertiser. You've done a great job. But online, the highest goal of advertising now is to generate a click.
Yeah.
And that is to me, that's the lowest attainment. That's not a high achievement. That's a very low achievement. But that's what they're aiming for. Everything is short term. Everything is, you know, they're checking the numbers today of ads they ran yesterday. They're not looking at the big picture. And it's very disheartening to me to see that advertising is very quickly becoming nothing but a direct response medium for many advertisers.
And I also wonder how much they check into what those clicks are worth in terms of cash, hard cash.
Yeah, they're worth nothing, essentially. But what they do is, if you're a media operator online, if you're a publisher online, you get paid based on clicks or on traffic. So you want to generate traffic to your site as much as you possibly can, and you really don't care too much about how it gets there.
So why is there not more analysis being put into what the advertising in that area that is so quantifiable delivering? They're not counting the right aspects of it, are they?
Yeah, they're measuring everything but what's important, as far as I can see. They're measuring everything but whether or not
it helps their brand or makes them money.
Building successful brands. I mean, if you walk through the supermarket in your neighborhood, you will find that there are virtually no brands there of anything. Soap, soda, toothpaste, beer, anything that have been built by online advertising.
No.
You can find some online brands that have been built by online advertising, but, you know, 93% of the stuff in the world is not sold online. It's sold in a store. And you can find almost no examples of soap, soda, beer, fast food, banks, clothing that have been built by online advertising. And we've had it for 20 years now. So why aren't we getting this? Why don't we understand this? We're not using the medium properly. There's no reason why the web can't be a good advertising medium. But we have made it into a mess. We thought, you know, when the web first came along as an advertising medium, we thought it would be like television or radio or magazines. that it would be a brand building kind of medium. But it's turned out that it's become a direct response medium. And if you look at there are two real genealogies, I think, of advertising. One is the kind of the Madison Avenue style of product and brand building advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And the other lineage of advertising is the junk mail lineage of advertising, which started with junk mail, and then it went to 800 numbers, call this number now, and then it went to junk faxes, and now it's junk electronic direct response stuff, which is essentially what online advertising has become. Now, it's not all that. I don't want to overstate it. But to a very large degree, all it is electronic junk mail.
And do you think that's just because that's where it's at in the sort of evolution of online? I guess it must evolve at some point. It seems very primitive still.
It is. And it's because online advertising was promised to us to be more measurable. And therefore, anything that got measured got paid attention to. And so the world of clicks became how you measured the effectiveness of advertising. And that leads to a direct response frame of mind, which is what I think online advertising has evolved into. Now, will it evolve past that? I sure hope so, because there's no reason why the web can't be a good advertising medium. There's no reason why it can't be a brand-building advertising medium. But thus far, it has not proven to me that it has been that.
So why are particularly clients, marketing directors, generally are pretty hard-nosed, you know, I mean, the issue often you would have is perhaps not being too worried about the finance instead of the long-term ambition of the brand and what the brand stands for. With some of the things they're doing now, it's not even a short-term gain or long-term gain. I don't know how it's gone that way.
I think it's because this is what they've been taught. They got their MBAs or they got their degrees in advertising, and for 20 years they've been taught about the primacy of online advertising. And it reminds me of doctors. For 2,000 years, doctors bled people, right?
Yeah.
If you were sick, they cut open your vein and bled you. And they did that for 2,000 years, despite the fact that it had no effect. But this is what they were taught. And for 2,000 years, they practiced what they were taught, and they kept doing it, despite the fact that it was ineffective. And I think that a lot of our marketing CMOs and marketing directors these days have been taught a certain thing and are doing it despite the fact that it's not very effective.
So the first time I came across this so directly was I did a TV ad and some other ads for a honey company in this country. And around 2000, and I'm trying to think when it was, 7, 8 maybe. It seems like it was almost the law to do ads that involved lots of people. So we had this concept of involving the company. They were making their own ad because we thought, oh, it's honey. What do you say? You know, the bees make it, not the company. It's very hard to get any specific thing on it. So we did this ad and put this ad out there. It was one of the early ads that linked into Facebook where you could vote on some part of it. So the ad went out. And it was seen by about, at that time, obviously TV was bigger, it was seen by about, say, 10 million people. The client was doing cartwheels when the likes were coming in on the site that were up to about 30,000. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't understand why they were so excited about the 30,000 likes when it had been seen by 10 million people who may go out and buy it. And they were absolutely following it day by day, like it's... I was thinking 30,000 is nothing. That's like putting an ad in a trade magazine. I don't see why it's so exciting. But, you know, they weren't looking at the where all the money was being spent on TV. They were just following the amount of likes it got every day.
Yeah, and it's funny how that has completely disappeared. That whole theory of advertising has collapsed. You know, the likeonomics that they're trying to gather as many likes as. And just 3 years ago, they were going crazy. Now, if you mention it at a meeting, you get laughed at. Who cares about likes? That's bullshit, right?
Yeah.
But if you said that 3 years ago, you were an idiot. If you said likes are bullshit 3 years ago, you're an idiot. Today, if you say likes are important, you're an idiot. So the fads and the trends come and go so quickly. And, you know, where we started this was, how is it different now from how it was when we started? And, you know, the circumstances change, but principles don't. The principles of advertising are still the same. You have to get someone's attention, and you have to show them something interesting, and you have to hope that you're convincing them to do something. And that hasn't changed, and it's not going to change.
So I'm going to go back slightly to when you were at Allen and Dorwood. And just trying to think, obviously, when I read your blogs now, I can see you're incredibly detailed and analytical. Were you that way as a writer?
I was.
Or were you much more gut? Yeah.
No, I've always been... I'm a precise writer because I'm not very fluent. So it takes me a while to write stuff. And even my blog posts, believe it or not, they are rewritten at least five times before they ever appear in the blog. Because one of the great motivators in my life is fear of embarrassment. I hate to be embarrassed. And so what I do is I check every fact three different ways. I check my grammar, a silly thing, grammar and spelling. I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to publish something that isn't true. I don't want to write something that is I used to have a guy who worked with me. He was a brilliant guy. He went on to be a novelist. He worked with me at Panasonic. And he was a stickler for grammar. And so if you wrote, and he was one of the supervisors, if you wrote something and the grammar wasn't right, he'd make you change it. And, you know, one or two of the writers would say to him, well, you know, why don't we, the syntax doesn't match. Nobody's going to care. Says, yes, someone's going to care. Someone who's intelligent, who's going to read this, is going to care. And I want that person, I want that intelligent person to think we're a quality company.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I tried to be assiduous in my writing, and I tried to be as careful as I can. Now, sometimes I shoot from the hip. There are days when I'm just pissed off about something, and I just, blast something out. But in general, I've always tried to be a little left brain and a little right brain. And, I hope it's imaginative, but I also want it to be correct.
So who were the creatives or the writers who inspired you coming through at that point?
Here in San Francisco, there was... Fortunately for me, when I was growing up in the agency business here in San Francisco, there were some wonderful agencies. I mean, Hal Reiney was here.
Yeah.
Later on, Jeff Goodby was here, still is. And there were some great, and there were some great writers here in San Francisco who nobody knows about. There's a guy named Walt Kramer who was amazing. Right. A guy named John Crawford who was amazing. And they weren't famous in the U.S. or anyplace else, but they were famous here, and they were great writers. And so they influenced me. And then, believe it or not, because I was self taught, because I had never gone to ad school or taken any advertising courses, I became a creative director, and I was running the creative department before I really knew very much. And a lot of the people who helped me were people who I hired. They were actually working for me, but they had a better, you know, they had worked at great agencies, and they had worked with great people. You know, they'd worked with worked with Hal, and they'd worked with other people. And so I learned a lot from people who worked for me.
So what quality made you their boss before them, or made you creative director before them, do you think?
I don't know, and I think it's one of the things that I always think about when I am thinking about my career, and that is that I became an agency manager maybe a little too soon, because I was never a great creative person. I was an okay creative person. I did some good things, but I was never really, really good. And I always wondered if I had stuck to the creative side more and not started up an agency and not become general manager of an agency, if I just focused on the creative stuff, could I have been a lot better than I was? And, I guess it's something you're always asking yourself when you're thinking about those kind of things. I don't really know how good I could have been. I think I could have been better than I was, though.
Well, I guess the challenge is once you start to become more senior and you're more involved in running the agency, it's very difficult to be selfish and go off on gut reactions that sometimes lead to very unusual award-winning famous creative work. Yeah. Lots of that comes out of selfishness and gut rather than, you know, if you're looking after a few hundred people.
That's exactly right. And I don't think many people in the agency business realize how much that affects your thinking. When you're running an agency and you have 100 people working for you, and you know that if you lose an account, you're going to have to fire 15 people. And it's not going to be you. You're not going to lose your job. But people with families and children and houses and are going to be laid off. Yeah. And it was always something that made me think twice before I acted rashly and before I put my needs before my clients' needs. I always thought twice. I have people here whose lives I need to protect. It's a burden. When I left the agency business, it was a burden that I was very happy to be rid of. It's not fun to ever have to let people go, particularly when they're hardworking, good quality people, and you just, you know, it's either let people go or go out of business because you don't have enough money to keep the business going. So it's tough. Tough place to be.
So what was your next job after Allen and Dorwood?
After Allen and Dorwood, Allen and Dorwood grew, and we were acquired by a company, an agency in Australia that was doing very well at the time called Mojo.
Yeah.
And Mojo was a very successful Australian agency that merged with another successful Australian agency called MDA, and they went public, and they did very well, and they bought our agency, and I worked for them for a couple of years, and they were, you know, they were trying to be a global agency. So they bought in the U.S., they opened an office in England, they had, I think they had an office, had a few other offices. I worked for them for a couple of years, but I was very unhappy working for them.
Why
I'm
is that?
I'm not a good employee.
Did they have
I'm
a different,
not a good employee.
Did they have a different philosophy, a or? Okay, so just not being able to call the shots and...
Yeah, I'm a great team player as long as I'm the captain. But if I'm not the captain, I have a hard time. And I didn't like what they were doing, to be honest. I didn't like their work very much. They had a great reputation.
Yeah.
You know, we won the International Agency of the Year Award from Ad Age. But their reputation, I thought, was really better than they were. They had a magnificent PR machine.
Right.
They were fabulous at PR. But the work, I felt, was it had a kind of sameness to it. It was jingles and people jumping around. And a little of that goes a long way as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, but they had a huge success with a guy, Paul Hogan. Remember the movie Crocodile Dundee? Yeah. So he was a friend of the agency's, and they used him for Australia tourism campaign that ran around certain, you know, a lot of markets around the world. And so they built on that reputation very, very cleverly and built the agency. And ultimately, Mojo was bought by Chiat Day.
Right.
I had already left Mojo 6 months earlier, but they were bought by Jay Chiat, and I think it was probably one of the worst business moves Jay Chiat ever made. He paid a lot of money for Mojo and had to sell it a few years later for a lot less than he bought it for. So after Mojo, I spent three... when I left Mojo, I had a kind of a non-compete with them. I wasn't allowed to work for any other agencies for a while. So I did freelance creative work. I had a creative services company, which I did for 3 years. And it was fun. I loved it. But I was lonely. I missed the agency environment. Agencies are, you know, they're terrible places to work, but they're great places to hang out. It's fun people, and, you know, and I miss that. So I had some opportunities to go back to big agencies, which I didn't want to do. I had an opportunity to get into the movie business, which I didn't want to do. And so I hired on with a guy named Roger Lewis, who had a small agency here in Oakland.
Right.
And I became a partner in his agency, and I brought the clients that I had from my creative services company over to the agency. And it was a small agency in Oakland. We moved to San Francisco. We moved into San Francisco, and we started to grow. And it was a nice agency. It was very nice, and it grew nicely, and we had some good clients, but I never felt that the work we did was as good as the work that I was doing at Mojo and Allen and George. And the reason for that is we had a lot of retail clients, and the degree of difficulty in doing good work for retailers, at least here in the States, is pretty high. I don't know how it is there in the UK, but here in the States, it's a high degree of difficulty to do good work. And our big clients were McDonald's and Toyota. And, you know, they're prestigious clients, but we were doing a lot of the retail side of those business, a lot of price item stuff and stuff like that. And it's hard to it's hard to stand out when you're doing a lot of that stuff.
So when you started Hoffman Lewis, was there a, did you have a very specific plan or a philosophy, or you just kind of, how did you approach it?
My approach was very opportunistic. When you're an independent agency in a large market where there are large companies, large agencies with big worldwide accounts, and you're just a small guy in that market, you have to be opportunistic. You have to take whatever comes along. I wish we had been a little more strategic. I wish we had, if we had said early on, you know what, let's be a retail agency. Let's do something well. Let's not try to be everything to everyone. If our two biggest accounts are retail accounts, let's be a retail agency. Let's say the dirty word, okay? Yeah. And let's see what we can do with that, and maybe we can turn it into something really good. But we didn't. We were, when you're in an agency, it's hard to say we're a retail agency. People don't like, the good creative people don't like to hear that. And I can understand why.
It's also hard to rule yourself out of any possible markets. There's a lot of agencies, some that are really good at high end or some that, but they never want to say that. Because they feel it's going to instantly rule them out of a lot of other stuff. But when it's the other way and you're talking to clients, you say, look, you're really good at that. Why don't you own that territory and expand it rather than try and be everything? But no agency owner ever says, we're really good at X. Tough.
Exactly. What we tell our clients, you need to differentiate.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's the last thing. It's great. But one thing that's great about the agency business is we know how to run everyone else's business but our own.
Absolutely. So what surprised you about setting up when you're on the other side and you're the guy writing the checks? Was there anything that took you by surprise?
About running an agency?
Yeah, about starting an agency and running it. Did it go as expected or was it more of a shock?
It was not shocking because I had become CEO of Mojo's U.S. operation, so I knew about the difficulties of running an agency, and I had been president of Allen & Dulwich, so I wasn't shocked by
the whole business side.
What was involved, in the whole business aspects of it. No, that didn't shock me.
Okay. And at what point did you start broadening out and writing blogs? So I kind of tried to find your first ever blog, which I think this is your first one, which made me laugh, which I think was in 2007. And if I'm right, is the first one. It makes me laugh because it says the top five bullshit marketing terms of 2008. 5, ideation. 4, authenticity. 3, mega brand. 2, conversion. 1, narrative. It just seems funny that that's 10 years ago and it's the same sort of issues.
I started writing, the funny thing about the blog was I started it not as a blog. I started it as I would write essays to myself. And the reason I would write essays to myself is that I was so frustrated by what I was seeing in the agency business that I just had to write it down. And the way I clarify thoughts in my mind is to write them. I know if I can write it down and it makes sense in the written form, then I'm thinking straight. If I can't make sense of it in written form, then I'm not clear on what I'm thinking. So around 1999, 2001, the dot-com boom was booming, and there were people coming into our agencies every week with millions of dollars to spend on the most idiotic dot-com ideas you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
And And I would sit there and say, what the fuck is going on? Are these people insane? Do they really think this is going to happen? And so we stayed away from all the dot-com potential clients, and we looked like idiots for about 2 years while everyone was cleaning up on these suckers. And then the whole thing crashed, and a lot of agencies went out of business, and all of a sudden we were geniuses because we didn't listen to the bullshit.
So
go ahead.
No, I was only going to ask how you managed to. I mean, there's not many people that could turn down that kind of business. It's modern. They've got lots of money. They seem slightly daft, you know. How did you, when it's your own company, turn down that business? I mean, you couldn't have predicted there's going to be a crash. Why did you do that?
Well, we had one dot-com account that we took that was actually pretty, it was not a terrible idea, but it crashed and burned eventually also. But it just didn't make sense to us.
Business.
The businesses that they were presenting to us, they just seemed unsustainable. They were living on investments, not on real operational income. They were living on investor money. And I guess the problem is, if it's a problem, we told them. We didn't bullshit them. I remember one guy saying to us, we're sitting in the meeting, and he's explaining his idea, and he says, you just don't get this, do you? And I said, no, I don't. And that was the end of the meeting. And that was, and maybe we were arrogant, or maybe we were making enough money doing what we were doing, or I don't know. But we didn't fall for it, and I think that, you know, we may have missed out on some short-term windfall money, but in the long term, we were a healthier company because we, I think we recognized the difference between business and bullshit.
So it makes you quite an unusual person to not either think, we'll just take the money, or secondly, I must be old-fashioned. It's just me. I don't get it. I need to go along with this because this is the future.
Yeah, it's a kind of arrogance that I'm not proud of. But I know who I am, and I know that it's hard for me not to say this is bullshit when I think it's bullshit. And you know, it's not that I'm always right. You know, I'm very often not right. Nonetheless, I have confidence, at least in my gut feel, that I know when something's right or wrong.
And how has writing the blog must have caused you problems? Because it's so unusually forthright. And I think when we spoke earlier, I said you seem like a cross between Woodward and Bernstein in that you not only say it, you kind of prove it. Has that caused issues?
Yeah, it caused issues at the agency. My partners hated the blog, and we disassociated the blog from the agency. But I just had to write it because I can't keep my mouth shut. And so the funny thing is my blog would get more visitors in a day than the agency website would get in a year.
Yeah.
And yet we disassociated the blog from the website because my partners were afraid, and I could see why they were afraid. What I was saying at the time was very negative and about what was going on in the advertising industry, and it was not popular. Now, what I'm saying today is essentially the same stuff, but it's not as what I'm saying now is not as controversial. I'm hardly even a contrarian anymore. I mean, there are so many people who have I think, come to realize what the problems have been in the advertising business in the past 10 years, and I'm no longer that far out on a limb, I don't think. But in those, at the beginning, I was.
Has it ever led to you winning clients?
The blog?
Yeah.
Not in the agency.
Right. No,
not when I was in the agency. But it has led me to get a lot of business now as a speaker. I do a lot of speaking, and the blog is the primary way that people who hire me to do speaking find out about it.
It's not led to assignments for advertising, because obviously I can't help but read it and think, if I was a marketing person, I would think he may be able to lead me through this new world of bullshit that most people don't seem to have a handle on. You know, most people don't give you any clear direction.
I am not looking for advertising business marketing business or even consulting business. I have done a few consulting gigs. I've done a few strategic gigs, but I don't really like it anymore.
Right.
Those days are over for me. I have there are other things that I'm interested in. I'm interested in my writing. I have a new book that I'm working on, and I'm interested in speaking. But I'm not really interested in consulting. Consulting is a pain in the ass. It's like a lot of work for not very much money. And what I find is that people who hire me for consulting gigs don't really want my opinion. They want my approval.
Right.
And I'm not good at giving approval to stuff I don't believe in. And so it hasn't been attractive to me.
I've noticed that, as you say, recently, I remember reading the one about BBDO becoming the social agency of the year for not doing social. And and I kind of read through that and thought, that's great. And then looked at the comments, and the first person was the head of planning at BBDO. So I thought, God, this is going to be interesting.
Right.
He's going to be furious. And he said, you're absolutely right. We use social as a TV medium, effectively, and you're absolutely right. I was surprised at how accepting he was of your sort of expose. And he said, no, it's 100%. That's exactly what we've done. Good for him for being honest. But do you think, as you say, you may have to change your title from contrarian to whatever the opposite is?
Yeah, absolutely. When I used to write negative things about social media, even 3 or 4 years ago, the social media people were the most sensitive. You know, I could write negative things about the agency business and get like no comments. But if I wrote something negative about social media, I would get emails, I would get hate stuff. They were extremely sensitive. But what has happened with social media is it ain't what it was supposed to be. It's changed. Social media used to be, it's going to replace advertising. It's free. You're going to go, you're going to post something on Facebook, and your friends are going to read it, and they're going to repost it to their friends, and there's going to be a tidal wave of viral interest in your brand, and it's all bullshit. Now everything on Facebook is a paid ad. It's paid traditional advertising.
Mm.
It's a completely different medium than what it was sold to us as. Facebook has done the greatest bait and switch job in the history of business. It's absolutely amazing.
So the whole, what were the two terms, earned and pay?
Earned media and what's the other one? And I don't know.
Earned media and whatever the other one. So you don't hear them anymore?
You hear it a little, but not that much. Earned and owned,
was it?
And, earned media is just public relations, right?
Yeah.
That's what earned media is. And so it's online, so, you know, it's supposed to be something different. But it's not. It's PR.
So do you think the fact that the social people at the time were so vociferous was basic insecurity, that they knew it was not all it was being cracked up?
It was insecurity. It was a strange amalgam of arrogance and insecurity. They were very arrogant about their beliefs and how advertising was a waste of time, and that social media, that people wanted to go online and join the conversation about brand.
Yeah.
Give me a fucking break. Who's try to find me a conversation about brand. Who believed that bullshit? And billions of dollars were wasted on promoting that bullshit. Yeah, join the conversation about our brand. Get the fuck out of here. Who's having a it's such bullshit. But they believed it. Now, you go to Facebook, there isn't a fucking conversation about a brand to be found. All there is paid traditional advertising. Big fat ads right in the middle of your Facebook feed.
Yeah. Well, I did a little test before I was going to speak to you. It came up on Twitter. Yeah. I just thought it would be interesting to do the process. So it came up on Twitter. Market your blog, whatever it was. So I filled in their forms, put down 100 quid or whatever it was, not much, and it filled in the whole process. What do you want? Followers, this thing, that thing, over this time. So I thought I'd speculate 100 quid. So I had to fill in the exact times, pick 2 days, I think I spread it over. So almost before that day had come, there was like 100 followers seemed to turn up in one go. And I thought, God, that's weird. That's like an hour in. We're an hour into these 2 days. Yeah. There's 100 followers. Seemingly no one then turned up over the next, 47 hours. So then I clicked through these new followers I'd got for a pound each. And they were all seemed to be from South America. And their pictures were like them going crazy on the beach. This is a generalization, but it was all pretty much the same kind of person. They were like jumping up and down on the beach, probably 23, in South America. They'd instantly signed up to my blog to follow that. And I'd look through their likes and their profiles and think, I can't find anything that would make me understand why that person would want to follow someone in London who's writing about ads, and there seemed to be nothing. And I don't know, you know, I don't exactly know how it works.
It's all scam. It's a scam. It's a scam.
Is it just as straightforward as that?
Absolutely. Those aren't real followers. They're made up. They're made up Twitter profiles that are, you know, and as soon as you sign up, whoever's running the scam sends them over to you as if they're real followers. Or they're people in Indonesia or the Philippines who sit all day and click on ads and click on websites, or they're bots. It's all a scam. You can go on when we're finished with the phone call. Go on Facebook and Google, and just search for followers. And you can see that people, how many followers you want? You want 10,000 followers? Okay, $250. And it's all bullshit.
But I guess the problem is, if I was running some beer company, and then I went in as marketing director and said to my boss, right, I want to spend $500,000 on Twitter. We want to build our base. We want to become better known, have more followers, and blah, blah, blah. And you spend $500,000. Presumably, you get $500,000 followers. So then the next year, you go into your boss, you say, we've had really good progress. We're now, you know, that money's translated into $500,000 followers. This is the modern world. We're moving in the right direction. So everybody wins, except the guy who owns the company, who owns the beer company.
The only person who wins is the scammer selling you the followers. Nobody else wins. The CMO looks good. For a little while, until
the social media company really gets money, yeah. The scammer gets money. Yeah. It's just the person who's written the check is the only loser in the process.
Yeah, the fool is the guy writing the check, always.
So I can see how that can perpetuate, because you can instantly get results, or even though they're bogus, by putting money into those things. Whereas going in to say, this seems very modern, or this seems, but actually what we want to do is review the whole way we're talking to people, and perhaps we want to do more TV or whatever the thing is a harder sell, I would imagine, for most marketing people.
Sure it is. The online stuff is so easy to sell. First of all, it's cheap, very cheap to advertise online. And you can, if you're a CMO, you can put out a little flow chart that shows 52 weeks of online advertising for, you know, $28. And you look like, oh, look, we're doing all this advertising.
Yeah.
Worthless, but it looks great on a flow chart, and people who don't know are impressed by it. If you want to do alibi advertising,
yep.
The web is the perfect place to do alibi advertising. You can make it look good for very little money.
But over in the States, that's starting to catch up with people, isn't it? Where people are going to court.
Yeah, some things are starting to catch up, but still, online advertising is growing double digits every year. It's going to be the number one medium. It's going to surpass television this year, according to most of the reports. So, they're doing okay.
So who doesn't want to be part of that, the number one medium?
Right.
All these people can't be wrong.
Right, exactly.
So where does that leave, you know, if you were getting into the business now? I mean, how would you begin to navigate? You know, it used to be quite a straightforward process. Could you imagine yourself getting into the business now? How would you?
I could imagine it, but I don't think I would be happy. All of my friends and the people I know in the business are not very happy. It's become too corporatized, too consolidated. There are just a handful of people with much too much power in the advertising business these days. And that has created a culture in the agency business, which I don't think is healthy and good. Once again, I want to be clear, that doesn't mean that there aren't some great agencies doing great work. There are some. But for the most part, I don't think I would be very happy in the agency business these days. There was always an element of bullshit in the advertising business. That's nothing new. There was always an element, there were always people who didn't know anything and were faking it in the agency business. That's nothing new. But what's new now is the amount of that stuff. There's so much bullshit. There are so many people who don't really know how advertising works, who are decision makers. I left the agency 4 years ago. I was very happy to leave. I haven't had a moment's regret since then. It's just gotten too difficult, it's just not as much fun, I don't think, as it used to be. I sound like an old guy, right?
Well, I don't know. It's always difficult weighing up these things. And partly, I remember I used to work on a radio station, and I found it really interesting that one of the researchers at the radio station said, you can always find the bullseye of someone's musical taste. It's the summer of their 16th, of when they were 16, which I thought was interesting. And it doesn't mean that they just listen to that music. It means that there would be sort of, that's the core thing. And there may be derivatives of that going forward. So obviously, you know, there may be part of that when you're come into it, it seems more exciting and fresher. But I just also wonder whether culture's changed along that way. Culture seems, you know, seems to have got a bit more money obsessed, not just advertising. I don't know whether it's proportionate, but doing something, it used to be, I remember when I first got into the business, trying to do something that hadn't been done was what people were trying to do. Few ever did it, but that was the trying to use words or pictures or film in a way that hadn't been done was the sort of holy grail. And I don't know whether that's the case anymore. You know, I often get young teams come in with ideas and they'll show me a bit of film as a reference and they'll show me a script and you think, oh, that's the same. It's as if you've typed up what you've just seen, you know, what you've just shown me. And they go, yeah, no, that's right. That's right. And I go, well, it's so, it's not really a reference. It's the same. You've changed the, seemingly changed the sort of logo at the end. I don't, and they go, well, we're showing you how it would work. And it seems so the opposite of certainly where it was when I started. It was, you know, if it had been done, that's not what you do. Whereas now, obviously, you kind of, to some degree, you need that to sell it in. It makes selling working easy if you can show an exact piece of film or the exact image. But obviously, it's very limiting. It's hard to then move forward if that's where it's
at. Isn't it sad that we have so many new media types now, so many different ways to communicate, so many new channels of media and communication, and we're starving for fresh ideas? You'd think that this would have spawned an explosion of fresh ideas, but it doesn't seem to have, has it?
Well, it's it doesn't, and I think it's interesting. I think that one of the processes, I think one of the issues that advertising as a business has is its desperation to appear new. And it doesn't seem to be the case in other creative things like fashion, film, whatever it may be. And I think at the moment people, I think it's changing a bit, but are so desperate to not be seen as old or traditional, which is obviously a terrible tag that agencies got tagged with. They're so desperate to be new that they don't want to be a contrarian. They don't want to say the truth. And if you can't admit what's right or wrong, you can't really move forward. And but I think it's the same in things like photography. You know, I've done a few interviews recently with photographers, and and it's so easy now to experiment with photography, but you seem to see less experimentation. So
it's it's very strange, and I think your point is a good one. Everyone is afraid to be seen as not on the cutting edge.
Yeah.
If you are labeled traditional in an agency, you might as well start looking for another job, because your traditional is code word for old and in the way. And there's a kind of low-grade McCarthy. Do you know the term
McCarthyism? Yeah, absolutely,
There's a kind of low-grade McCarthyism in the agency business, that if you're labeled a certain way, you're done, you're dead. And it's horrifying, it's terrible, because the people doing the labeling, for the most part, don't know anything. And the people who are questioning it are being stigmatized for being skeptical. And skepticism, in my opinion, is the key to intelligence. If you're gullible, if you believe everything you're told, and you're not skeptical about it, and you don't investigate, and you don't analyze it carefully, you can be persuaded to believe anything.
Absolutely. I think, again, I think skepticism was probably the number one part of a creative department. So every brief that would come in, it would be a pain in the ass for, you know, account people and planners, but every brief that would come in, the creatives would say, well, is that really true? Does that make sense?
Yeah,
does anyone
why?
Care? Right. Would anyone notice? But right. isn't that the same as X right. and Y? And in that context, that led to more focused thinking. There are certain aspects of, but why would you follow that on Twitter? But would you really engage with that conversation where they don't embrace that in the same spirit and they will go, well, that's just doesn't get it. You know, that that skepticism, a bit like McCarthyism, isn't valued. And obviously being skeptical of something is the first step to solving it. You know, you've got to be skeptical about every aspect. Otherwise you waste people's money. But it's not being, skepticism isn't something you hear, you don't even hear the word very, very often anymore.
No.
But it's but it's a positive, not a negative word.
It absolutely is.
So I would be tempted to ask you what's going to happen in the future, but obviously I know you always say, who the hell knows? But it's interesting reading your early blog on the biggest bullshit words of 2008. How little things have changed in a sense. But I guess I can't help thinking at some point the humanity must come back because the people haven't changed that much that we're talking to. The methods have, but the psychology of the people that you're trying to get through to hasn't really changed that much.
I wish I could believe that there will be that the pendulum will swing back to humanism and to thinking about people rather than numbers. But I have to say I am skeptical. If anything, I think it's going further in the wrong direction. And I think we're going to be subjected to more numbers rather than less, and fewer ideas rather than more. And I hope I'm wrong.
Well,
if I had to bet, that's the way I'd bet.
Well, the only thing is I have to be slightly more optimistic, but I think, nobody would have predicted a few years before Obama got in that he would have got in. He was the wrong person to get in at that point. And obviously nobody did predict that Trump would get in. I mean, you know, who knows if you just keep going down this road of trying to turn everything into numbers. And trying to systems and formulas and all the things that were used to be considered not a very useful tool to speak to other humans and try and cut through.
But you know what I'm seeing? All the numbers, when they're wrong, you know, when all the numbers, all the predictors of the future, when they're wrong, they don't say, oh, gee, you know what? Our numbers were all wrong. We need to think more about, we need to think bigger than just numbers. They say, oh, our numbers were wrong. We need more numbers. We need more better numbers. That's what they say. And that is, I'm afraid, where we're headed.
How do we end on a more positive note? I don't want to end on that gloomy note, Bob. Tell me something positive happening.
We can sing it. Okay, what's positive is I think people are starting to realize how much bullshit they've been fed over the past 10 years. I think the rebellion against ad tech that is going on by marketers who are starting to cancel their online advertising until it can be cleaned up.
Yeah.
That's positive. I am hoping that this will allow people to reevaluate and to be skeptical about what they're being told and to learn how much fraud there is and to learn how much corruption there is in online advertising. And maybe this will reset some minds about where advertising needs to go and how people really how people really react to advertising and the importance of doing stuff that isn't just, that doesn't just work by the numbers, but that appeals to us as human beings and helps us build more effective and better brands based on doing good advertising.
That sounds good. Sounds positive. It's like, it reminds me of the Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the first step to solving the problem is admitting you've got one. So,
yeah.
That sounds positive.
So.
I'm going to go out on that positive note, Bob.
Hey, this has been a pleasure.
It's been great to talk to you. I really appreciate your time. Sorry it took a while in the beginning to hook up.
No problem.
Thanks again, Bob. Have a nice day.
Thank you. You too.
All the best. Bye.